Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. This is from stlouistoday.com. Jury gives death sentence to St. Charles man convicted in quadruple homicide.
Richard Darren Emery, convicted of murdering his girlfriend, her two children, and her mother in 2018, was sentenced to death Tuesday. After roughly 2 hours of deliberation, the jury unanimously recommended Emery should die. Emery hung his head, embraced his lawyers, and cried while his family and friends also shed tears. Emery was convicted after a weeks-long trial in which a bevy of witnesses, including Emery himself, took the stand. Emery's attorneys argued throughout the trial he had a mental illness that caused him to go into a dreamlike state when he shot Kasten, then the others. But prosecutors prevailed with an argument that Emery knew exactly what he was doing that night, systematically killing three generations of a family in less than a minute and trying to make a getaway. Prosecutor Phil Groenigay argued during the punishment phase, which began Saturday, that after Emery killed his girlfriend, he then killed the others to eliminate witnesses. He shot at police and carjacked a woman, stabbing her 7 times, all in the name of self-preservation, Groenigay said. Send him the message that in St. Charles County, we will not tolerate this in any way. Emery's friends and family testified Saturday and Monday, talking about Emery's life and how they were shocked to learn he'd killed the family he'd always wanted. On Tuesday, prosecutors and defense attorneys made their final arguments. Defense attorneys asked the jury to have mercy on a man who had never given anyone a reason to suspect he could brutally murder 4 people. They asked the jury to picture his family, including his son, Tyler Emery, sitting in a room and watching their loved one die of a lethal injection. There has been so much pain, so much grief, and so much loss, and we are asking you now to choose mercy, said Emery's attorney Stephanie Zipfel. We are asking you to choose life. Judge Fagers will formally sentence Emery on November 3rd, prosecutors said. If he confirms the death sentence, an execution date will be set.
Next article.
Ferguson city manager announced he was quitting his job in the middle of a heated argument with a city council member at a recent public meeting. But the mayor said on Tuesday that was just a moment. Eric Osterberg did not immediately return a request for comment regarding his self-proclaimed resignation as city manager during a September 27th city council meeting. Ferguson Mayor Ellen Jones said Tuesday that Osterberg will address the public at the city's next council meeting on October 11th. He's just going to address the public about what he said. He just got emotional, the mayor said. He's not going anywhere. Contrasting opinions flared between Osterberg and city council member Tony Burrow about whether the city should require exit interviews, especially when an employee gets fired. This is the last time I'm going to be speaking with you, Councilwoman Burrow. I would like to announce my resignation effective immediately. The mayor said, nope, nope, no, 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 no. That is serious, said Osterberg, before he and Burrow spoke at the same time, prompting the mayor to call the meeting to order. Ferguson's government structure places the city manager as one of the top administrative and policymaking officials. The city council hires the city manager. Osterberg took over as city manager last August, hailing from Oregon, where he was assistant city manager for Klamath Falls. He told the Post-Dispatch at the time, I think that there is a shadow hanging over Ferguson from the past few years, but I believe with my experience and working together with the council, we'll be able to move past that. Before Osterberg, John Hampton served simultaneously as fire chief and the interim city manager for about 6 months. Hampton took over after the departure of the city's previous interim manager, Jeffrey Bloom. residents, protesters, and civil rights groups had called for the removal of Bloom after the U.S. Justice Department criticized him in a 2015 report showing while as finance director, he encouraged police officers to write more traffic tickets to increase city revenue.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. Alan Miller was scheduled to be executed September 26, 2022 in Alabama prisons. However, the botched execution of Alan Miller brings grave concerns of the kill team and processes in preparation in Alabama prisons, followed by the prison strike in Alabama, where at least four prisons remain on strike indefinitely. Alan Miller's botched execution, Unicorn Riot, who got an interview with Kinetic Justice, one of the labor organizers in Alabama prisons. Kinetic Justice talks about the dismal prison conditions in Alabama, where the governor of Alabama, Governor Lee, already states no deal with prisoners. However, the prisoners have more time than the state has money. Our concern here is there's 7,000 jails and prisons in the United States that lack transparency. Keep that in mind. We got a cell phone video of guards in Holman Prison beating prisoners with nightsticks for refusing to go to their cells. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. This is from Death Penalty Information Center, September 26, 2022. Federal court orders Alabama to preserve evidence of botched attempt execution of Alan Miller. A federal district court has ordered Alabama state officials to preserve evidence related to the state's failed attempt to execute death row prisoner Alan Miller on September 22, 2022. The botched execution attempt, Alabama's third since 2018, came from a divided U.S. Supreme Court issued after our execution night order setting aside without opinion an injunction that had barred the state from executing Miller by any method other than nitrogen hypoxia. Prison officials then unsuccessfully attempted as many as 18 times to establish an intravenous execution line before calling off the execution as the midnight deadline for carrying it out approached. Miller's lawyer filed an emergency motion in federal court on September 23, 2020. To grant them immediate access to their client to photograph and take video of Miller to preserve evidence of the injuries he sustained during the execution attempt. A confidential account provided by the DPIC by the individual with personal knowledge had no association with the case indicated that Miller had about 18 needle marks in his arms and legs after the failed execution. In granting Miller's motion, U.S. District Court Judge R. Austin Huffaker decided the Alabama Department of Corrections, ADOC, to allow a medical doctor retained by Miller's counsel access to Miller to evaluate his condition. The court also ordered ADOC to locate and preserve all evidence and all communications relating to the attempted execution. The Supreme Court's 5-4 order issued by the five male Republican justices on the court over the bipartisan dissent of the court, four female justices, came shortly after 9 p.m. Central Time, 3 hours after the execution was scheduled to begin. It nevertheless provided the Alabama Department of Corrections nearly 3 hours to perform the execution before the midnight expiration date of Miller's death warrant. After the execution team spent 2.5 hours unsuccessfully attempting to do so, Alabama Corrections Commissioner John Hamm blamed their failure on time constraints resulting from the lateness of the court proceedings. He said the execution was called off once it was determined that condemned inmates' veins could not be accessed in accordance to our protocol before the expiration death warrant. The Department of Corrections transported reporters to the prison to witness the scheduled execution, then without explanation left them at the gate for approximately 45 minutes before returning them to the media center.
Stick with us, Dr. Trapp!
Thank you.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. The Alabama Department of Corrections said they did not have Miller's form and sought to execute him by lethal injection because the state was not prepared to carry out executions by nitrogen hypoxia. On the afternoon of the scheduled execution, a panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit voted 2-1 to deny state prosecutors' motion to vacate Judge Huffaker's injunction. The majority wrote, prison officials at Holman chose not to keep a log or list of those inmates who submitted an election form choosing nitrogen hypoxia. They lost or misplaced the election form submitted by another inmate at Holman, and a prison guard did not turn in the form of the third inmate. District court found, following an evidentiary hearing, that it is substantially likely that Mr. Miller submitted a timely election form, even though the state says it does not have any physical record of a form. The state does not challenge the factual findings and has completely failed to argue, much less show that it will suffer irreparable harm. In filing before the Supreme Court appealing the Circuit Court, Alabama official argued that Miller claimed that the state neglected in failing to keep records of his section of nitrogen hypoxia did not amount to a violation of his rights. Miller has therefore alleged at most of the ADOC was insufficiently careful with handling his method of execution forms, but the guarantee of due process has never been understood to mean that the state must guarantee due care at the part of its officials. In response, Miller's attorney called the state's argument Kafkaesque and argued that the state was unnecessarily rushing to execute their client. Where is the emergency? The state of Alabama wants to proceed with the execution of Alan Miller by lethal injection tonight. Mr. Miller is not going anywhere, and neither is the Alabama Department of Corrections, they wrote. The state is manufacturing an emergency need to execute Mr. Miller, despite the fact that the state can execute Mr. Miller once it finalizes its nitrogen hypoxia execution protocol. In granting Miller's emergency motion to preserve evidence relating to the failed execution, Judge Huffaker directed the prison to allow a medical doctor retained by Miller's counsel access to Miller to evaluate his condition. The court also ordered ADOC to locate and preserve all evidence related to the attempted execution of Mr. Miller on September 22, 2022, including but not limited to all medical charts, reports, and notes that were prepared, rely upon, documented, or otherwise used. All medical materials and equipment, including but not limited to syringes, swabs, scalpels, IV lines that were used or otherwise relied upon, including any medical waste. In addition, Judge Huffaker ordered that the state officials to produce all communications relating to the attempted execution of 922 from personnel employed, contracted by, or otherwise associated with Holman, the Alabama Department of Corrections, Alabama Attorney General's Office, including emails, phone calls, text messages, notes, or any other form of communication written or otherwise. Alabama has one of the most expansive execution secrecy policies in the country, and has aggressively concealed the execution practices from the media, the public, and counsel for death row prisoners. It has failed to provide any explanation to the public about what occurred behind that execution curtain during the botched execution of Joy James and the failed execution of Ham and Miller. When states refuse to open about issues like this, that's a big red flag, said Robert Durham. DPIC Executive Director, the botched three executions say, trust me, I'm Alabama. That's not a good justification. This is the Abolitionist Hour.
It's a soul about their hook and every scream.
See, it's not the siphon of his control.
If you really see the light, it's a
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. Kinetic Justice talks about the dismal prison conditions in Alabama.
September 28, Officer Kyle brought several inmates from other dormitories to the dorms come talk to me. They began going around prison trying to find out what they could do to get people to go back to work. And once they got a group of people together, they came and talked to me, and I explained to them that was not our goal, that was not our objective. We were doing this for a goal, for a objective. We were doing this for the comfort of the officers, but I helped the officers be able to run the prison. That was not the point of what we were doing. So I told everyone in the group, as well as the officer, that we were on strike until we were able to see our opportunity to go home, which is repealing the habitual sentence and making the sentencing guidelines retroactive. That's what will give us an opportunity to be able to work out a way back to our families. And that's what we're on strike about. We're not on strike about seeing how long we could go on strike, or how long we could bid one meal a day, or how long we could go without receiving medical treatment, or how long we could go without mental health counseling. That was not our goal and our objective. So I refused the administration's plea to get everybody to go back to work. After that, guys came back again and said that they were with us. I have a few partners of mine that are in segregation and have been for years, and the administration refused to let them out. Yesterday, they offered to let three of my friends out of state who have been in state for years if everybody could go back to work. I kind of got irate with the group and thought, don't play with me. And what, they let them out of lockup, what, they still gonna walk alone and ain't got a chance to go home. What, they let them out then? I don't know why y'all coming to me with these pleas from the administration. Why are y'all even talking to the administration? Why are you even concerned about him talking about how hard it is to feed a meal? If y'all come on back first, we can, everybody can eat like they're supposed to, and we can do this. That's what you paid to do anyway. That's your job. That's not our responsibility. And after that, we made clear that we wasn't coming on strike and that we were satisfied in our strike from limestone, pounds, and bills. Like, we were solidified in our conversation that this is what we were doing. So we weren't going back to work to make life easier for 23, 24 officers who were trying to run a prison with 2,300 people. About an hour after that, 13 and a several officers came at the B dormitory where I sleep. They came in on my side and they counted. They did the count. They fell out on my side when they brought calls to the other side and counted the other side. And when they came and counted, like they were getting ready to go out of the building, they all came back onto the side. I sleep in and all of them went directly to my cell. I was not in my cell. I was in the TV room watching the news. One of the officers hit the window of the TV room and told me to come to my cell. When I got up and went to my cell, there was an officer from the 13th inside my cell, and one was standing outside my cell. So when I went into the cell, they asked me, did I have any contraband, and I clarified I didn't. I submitted to a strip search. As I went through the strip search, I stepped out of my cell to allow them to shake my cell down. And while I was standing outside the cell, as they were shaking down, one of them told me that when we finish shaking you down, you can go and pack your property, you're going to restricted housing. So I said, go restrict the housing for what? I ain't broke no rules. I ain't violating no ADOC regulations. I ain't. So what you mean I got to go restricted housing? I'm saying, there's 120 people and they all doing the exact same thing. So why is it that I am targeted and harassed and intimidated to try to make everybody go to work? And I said, well, you might as well get your supervisor and get some body cams. So in the world can see how y'all treat a person who's non-violent, and they ain't broke no rules or regulations. And this is just what you want to do to try to undermine the strike, to try to get these people to go back to work so y'all can get back to making the money that the state of Alabama makes. And at that point, one grabbed me by one arm and tried to break my wrist. One grabbed me by leg, and then they slammed me to the floor and drug me about four more times, and they drug me out of the dorm and threw me on a trash cart outside and pulled me to the infirmary on a trash cart. With handcuffs that were so tight on my hand that I can't even feel my fingers today. Right now, I can't feel my fingers. But I was taken to the infirmary, asked my name, and received no medical treatment. Didn't look at my injuries, didn't check my vitals, and I was brought to segregation and placed in a cell with no property or nothing for several hours. Until last night, they brought me to property.
Here we go!
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. At least four prisons remain on strike indefinitely in Alabama.
The actions started on Monday and include inmates who serve food and do other jobs around the prison. They are protesting against inhumane conditions they face behind bars. Companion protests outside facilities among non-incarcerated individuals also took place and were sponsored by the group Both Sides of the Wall. Problems with Alabama's prison system have long been documented. Back in 2019, the Department of Justice accused the state of violating incarcerated people's constitutional rights. And in 2020, the department launched a lawsuit against the state for not addressing the several problems it identified, including preventing inmate-on-inmate violence and sexual abuse, failing to stop the use of excessive force against inmates, and creating prison conditions that amounted to cruel and unusual punishment under the Constitution. The next phase of that lawsuit isn't set to begin until 2024. Those who are on strike inside Alabama jails today released a list of demands to the state's Department of Corrections. They included the repeal of certain laws that carry automatic harsh sentences, an end to life sentences without parole, and a streamlined review of medical furloughs. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey, however, dismissed the demands. She called them unreasonable and flat out not welcome in Alabama.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. We'll be right back.
So to let you know what COINTELPRO was, it was J. Edgar Hoover's program to infiltrate, dislocate, disrupt any lawful political organizations, which J. Edgar Hoover didn't like. They had wiretaps, bugs, surreptitious mail openings, break-ins. They sent anonymous letters and all to break up marriages. They disrupted meetings, ostracized people from their professions, got people fired from their jobs. They provoked target groups into rivalries that could result in death. They dynamited publishing places of dissident press organizations. And from our program on the Klan, we found out that the Klan had organized over 40 chapters of the Klan in North Carolina alone back in the 60s. But they're wanting to do it again, but supposedly more gently. But in the June 83 edition of the Inquiry magazine, Matt Henthoff says, watch out, folks. The interpretation which William Webster gives on what they can do is much more broad than even tail gunner Joe McCarthy had in his heyday. And the new guidelines give to the agents to let them go on their feelings as to what may advocate what they consider to be criminal activity, and that could be most anything. As the article ends, it says, if keeping tabs on mere public advocacy is an authorized law enforcement activity in the domestic security field, then between what the FBI hears from soapboxes and informants and learns from collectively signed ads and letters to newspaper editors, folks, get ready for another COINTELPRO program.
It's wonderful to be back. And speaking of years, all of us have had a crazy 2.5 fucking years. But here we are. Here we are once again, all of us together. Together. Yeah. And I know, much like all of us on stage, all of you out there, what helped get you through those 2.5 years, wherever you fucking isolated, was music. Alcatraz, it was music. And right now, here we are all gathered together to celebrate fucking music. And more so than that, to celebrate life. Now I'm gonna ask you this, Alcatraz. Are you ready to celebrate thrash metal with Death Angel? Then I need you to keep on doing what you're doing, and you motherfuckers need to physically remind me what fucking festival I'm at. You got me? Do you got me? Prove it. This is a song called The Dream Calls for Blood.
Right.
as an example of the sort of thing that the FBI has been doing over the last several decades in the subversive groups that they've been infiltrating and harassing. One case is the National Lawyers Guild. They've recently put a multi-million-dollar lawsuit through the courts claiming that the FBI has been illegally harassing them, surveilling them, infiltrating their group since the 1940s. And during this lawsuit, a document came out that revealed that an FBI informer within the National Lawyers Guild Bar Association has every year been leaking to the FBI a list of all of the names of the members of the National Lawyers Guild that the FBI has put into its files to keep information on and to surveil. And they've also, the National Lawyers Guild, has uncovered over 400,000 pages of documents that the FBI had amassed on them that are in FBI files, showing the depth of the surveillance of the FBI on the National Lawyers Guild. And they claim that another 3 million pages of documents have also been amassed by the FBI that the FBI has refused so far to release, but that Freedom of Information suits are trying to get opened up and disclosed. So here's an example of the kinds of groups that the FBI claim you have to keep their eye on. The National Lawyers Guild, this very subversive organization of liberal lawyers.
There's, in this article in Inquiry, it says that not only will the new guidelines allow the FBI to continue investigations into organizations, but it can do it even when an organization is inactive, like if the International Workers of the World, the old IWW Wobbly, if they wanted to get organized again, the FBI would be there, be one of the first ones to join up to continue their surveillance of them. And this is a guideline, even if there is no immediate harm from the organization.
Keep it up, this was Tom Tasker! We'll be right back.
Special thanks to Unicorn Riot. Please contact and make a donation. Thanks to Non-Means TV. You can find them at Twitter. Thanks to It's Going Down. And thanks to The Memory Hole. You can find them at Patreon, The Memory Hole. Our playlist tonight is Alcatraz Festival. Bands like Amaranth, Ex-Hoarder, Death Angel, and Life of Agony. Also, I'd like to apologize to our local listeners about all the country music that I played a couple weeks ago. And this is the Abolitionist Hour, real underground AM radio on Radio Free. American-Iranian author Mash Alanjad has been targeted for kidnapping inside the United States by the Islamic Republic. We have a short audio clip from Iran at a demonstration from a woman who had been jailed. Bella Chow, sung by Iranian dissidents.
To be honest, emotionally, I got angry. I got furious. Instead of just, being scared, it made me furious that this is the nature of the Islamic Republic, kidnapping people, arresting protesters, killing them, murdering them. But here in America, I was shocked from the beginning when I heard the details, because I didn't know about the details. I didn't know that they're going to take me with a speedboat to Venezuela and kidnap me from there to Iran. So this is not new for us Iranians. But it was new that the Islamic Republic is allowed to have such an operation in the United States of America.
I'll come back to that point in a moment, but you identified yourself as the target. The FBI didn't in these indictments, but what have the authorities said to you directly about it?
Yeah, the FBI actually came to my house from the beginning, said that you're not safe in this house. And I just made a joke and I said, look, I receive daily death threats just because of just giving voice to Iranian people within the society. My family being targeted, like my brother is in prison right now. He received 8 years prison sentence because of being my brother. They interrogated my 70-year-old mother. They actually brought my sister on Iranian national television to disown me publicly. So I'm used to it. But what is new? Then they came later and they showed me they showed me actually the photos of me, like my private life. They showed me the photos of my stepchildren, my husband. And that was the time that I took them serious.
Yes, because the details of this are quite extraordinary. Even the FBI head of the New York office was saying exactly that. I mean, apparently relatives were in Iran. Your relatives were offered money to betray you. There were private investigators hired to spy on your house. You referenced it. They had done research on speedboats and routes through Venezuela to get out. When you saw that level of detail, you must have been frightened as well as shocked and angry, as you said earlier.
Of course. You know, as a human being, you get scared when you think that you're safe in your own land, in a free country. But at the same time that you've been warned by the top officials from FBI that you're not, I got scared. But to be honest, I told myself that for years and years, the government tried to create fear within the society, tried to scare us. But this is the time that actually the government of Iran, the whole intelligence service of Iran, they are scared of me and millions of people who are trying actually to send videos to me to express themselves.
You've overcome a challenge for many exiled dissidents, in that you've stayed relevant, you've stayed influential in Iran despite being forced out of the country via really a truly remarkable use of social media to amplify voices from inside the country. And I wonder how you manage that.
Look, because social media is a weapon. To be honest, now Iranians are brave enough to be their own storytellers. All I do, I just echo their voices to different media. Why? Yeah. Because the Iranian regime have their own lobbyists, apologists. They're all over around the world just trying to convince the West to get a nuclear deal. But I'm here to echo the voice of Iranian people within the society, actually asking a simple demand that while we're getting killed in Iran, stop negotiating with our murderers. Cut off all your ties with the Islamic Republic. So I'm echoing their voice. You know, you don't see that the Iranian right now facing guns and bullets, burning American flag, no?
Yeah.
They don't even ask for nuclear deal. They're not even chanting against sanctions. They're chanting against the Islamic Republic. And that is why I'm here to ask Biden administration, hear this voice and ask your European allies to recall their ambassadors because people are getting killed. Mm. I'm asking my sisters in America, Feminist Global Movement. I was one of them. I took to the streets in New York for chanting My Body, My Choice for Women's March. Mm. But Iranians' version of Women's March is bloody. Women are getting killed. I'm asking my sisters in America to take to the streets in Europe. When George Floyd brutally got killed, the whole world rightfully got united. Now Mahsa Amini and many other people getting killed. I'm begging you, take to the streets and giving voice to Iranian true leaders.
In the name of women, life, freedom, she was threatened in Iran. She was threatened to death because of this body. But look at her body. Why are you afraid of women's bodies? It's the body that we all were born out of. These are the breasts that we all drank milk from.
Continue with the memory hole. They talk about the conflict of interest between management consulting firms and auditing firms. Banks have been lying for years. What was the real military budget during the Reagan administration? Covert operations in the third world has caused death and suffering in the millions. We look at some numbers from Center for Defense Spending during the Reagan administration's expansion of the military apparatus. This is the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. I'm Carl G.
Anti-Italian discrimination. Columbus Day is a day of Italian pride. It's our holiday, and they want to take it away.
Columbus Day is coming up, which means it's time for the annual debate over canceling the holiday. New York Democrats are heading to Albany to try to make that happen, introducing legislation last week in an effort to officially cut it from the calendar. Laura, never mind the historical presence of it for so many decades here in this country and here in this state.
Yeah, I mean, it's so sad to see this. My birthday is actually October 12th.
Ah,
so growing up, occasionally, I would have the day off of school for Columbus.
I'm not going to speak to you.
Alderman Thomas Dillard quickly made it clear he does not want to talk about what WSMV4 investigates uncovered.
Go on. I'm not going to speak to you. You can ask me the question all you want to.
Video of him repeatedly.
I called him the N-word. I ain't gonna lie.
Using racial slurs, including effing porch monkeys.
Do not yell racial profanity.
Towards the Campos family next door. Someone on Dillard's property was also recorded making monkey sounds. And flipping off the Campos' biracial children. And his anger isn't just directed at the Campos family. This new video shows police responding to a complaint that someone at Dillard's house was setting off fireworks over the Campos' house. Watch how he approaches one of the officers and how that officer responds.
Sir, you need to back up.
I would recommend you getting off of my property.
And what the officers say about him when they leave.
That'd be one of your city councilmen.
Yes, always a pleasure and a standing member of society.
For Alderman Brian Woodall, he's seen enough.
Do I feel as if he should remain an alderman? No, I don't feel as if he should because I don't think he represents the entire community.
We also put the question to the city's mayor.
Do you think he should resign? Does he have a place on the council with these kinds of views?
Well, as we put before, as we said in the statement before, a lot of people don't feel like he can represent them anymore.
A mayor who apparently is going to have some competition on Election Day.
Do you think you should stay on the council?
Yes, I'm going to stay on the council.
Despite you making racist comments.
I'm running for mayor.
I'm asking you what you would say to the people of color in this community.
City business.
You have said racist comments repeatedly on camera.
I've got to get in here and speak.
After we followed him in, we asked one more time.
If there's anything you want to say to us now.
I'm not going to speak to this man at all about anything.
But knowing what we've documented, we'll still be asking questions. In Portland, Jeremy Finley, WSMV4 investigates.
Round two, the one! We'll be right back.
remember the San Francisco Bay Area. And we were so honored once again to play our particular brand at fucking Alcatraz.
This program was made before the Sandinistas lost the elections of 1990.
I remember in training in the CIA, our instructors, this was about 65, and the thing in China was winding down, and our instructors were all old China hands. and they would over beer at happy hour, they would be telling us sea stories about how, yeah, they'd find somebody that was just a rotten apple in the team, and so they would tie his parachute shut. So when they kicked him out over China, his shoe wouldn't open, and that would be the way they would get rid of people they didn't like and whatnot. A CIA case officer working for me in the Angola covert action, he used to tell us that when he was up country in Thailand, he would do figures, 7,000 communist troops, and they would ask him where he got it, and he would just, I made it up. He'd just type it in. There would be 70, and he'd write in 7,000. And they began to call it in Thailand fossilizing, was where you just put in figures to suit what you wanted to, you know, what you knew your bosses wanted to get. The Oversight Committee of the Senate, in one of the heated debates where they're clashing with Casey, leaked or admitted or stated publicly that there were 50 major covert actions going. And mind you, there are 170 countries in them. I mean, that's almost a third of the countries are being destabilized by the CIA, by CIA covert action. These policies cause gigantic suffering in the third world. Rape, murder, starvation, death by white phosphorus. You know, white phosphorus gets in your body and the doctors will put it out. It burns from the contact with the fluid and it will reignite 3 days later and start burning again.
In the body?
Inside the body. This is what we're using to bomb villages in El Salvador today. The suffering that we, this great lovable nation of ours, is inflicting by policy on the third world is mind-boggling.
Yeah.
featuring former CIA official John Stockwell, and take a look at CIA activity around the world, tonight on Alternative Views.
John Stockwell, former CIA agent, who's the author of the book In Search of Enemies, and in recent years has been traveling widely in Central America and has lectured on the CIA and the Reagan administration and has closely monitored its activities. So, John, welcome again to Alternative Views.
Well, before we talk to John Stockwell, here are some news stories.
How about them Republicans? We got some fine gentlemen up there in our government in Washington, D.C. I'm talking, of course, about the resignation of John Leather and Lace Fetters, the former head of the Enforcement at Security and Exchange Commission. It seems like he's been working on his jab, using his wife as a sparring partner, whether she wants to or not. Resigned after an article in the Wall Street Journal this week detailed his pugilistic propensity as a quote-unquote helpmate. Now, Republicans seem to have a problem with this. You remember not too long ago in Mr. Reagan's first administration, there was Alfred Bloomingdale, and after he died, there were all kinds of stories in the woodwork about his sadomasochistic tendencies. And
he hasn't been doing too much enforcing over the SEC. In fact, nothing has been enforced too much over the Securities and Exchange Commission over the past few years. It seems that the SEC and the U.S. Congress are going through their little mating dance, which they trip out on every few years, and that is shaking their finger at the accounting and auditing industry, particularly the Big Eight. There are the top eight firms just loom large over all the others, and they're the ones that have the big accounts. They don't do their job too well according to ethics, perhaps, but they do according to profit and according to what's good for business. Of course, now, auditing and accounting firms are supposed to be objective. They're supposed not to be involved in the company that they're working with or on. It's very important for the capitalist system because accounting firms are the ones that supposedly keep the big corporations in line and provide information to the management so they can make whatever changes so that the corporation will be more efficient. Well, there are a lot of conflicts that have been going on. First of all, these very few accounting firms have as their clients many competitors, which are a potential conflict of interest. Secondly, these firms have gotten into the management consulting business. So here is an automatic built-in conflict of interest. If an accounting firm has an account with Company B to do management consulting, and then this accounting firm goes in with its auditing outfit, and you know they're not going to give bad marks to Company B's management because their own firm has been doing the management consulting for them. So there are problems in this regard. There are problems on the flip side, which we found in so many bank failures in the past few years, and that is, if a company gets some bad remarks or bad marks on an audit, they just fire that corporation and get another one, not the corporation, the firm, and they get a new auditing firm, which will tell them what they want to hear. So this has been going on for years, and ever so often the government looks at it and they say, SEC, you start cracking down, and they tell the industry, now you folks have got to clean your own house and take care of it, and we'll see what happens later. And later it happens again. The old circle around again.
Frank, now that we're on a roll about corporations, I have another little article out of the Wall Street Journal earlier this month, a story about a study done for Corporate Travel magazine. The study said that a U.S. executive working out of town costs his or her company an average of $137 a day in housing, food, and transportation costs. Now, New York City is number one, of course, with an average daily cost of about $230, followed by Boston at about $204, Washington at about $200 a day. The least expensive place, by the way, on the list is the Melbourne, Titusville, Cocoa, Florida metropolitan area. And that still costs $96 a day. So it's pretty obvious that these executives, when they go abroad, are not exactly staying at your Motel 6s and eating at McDonald's. Now, the editor of the magazine, Jane Edelstein, says, quote, American business last year spent about $80 billion on corporate travel and entertainment.
Craig, we were talking about the auditing and all. It seems that, and accounting firms. This is also mentioned in a story in the Spotlight in which they quote, one of the international financiers of the Rockefeller Empire, Felix Reuten. He says that the whole financial services industry, the banks, etc., are on a burnout and short circuit direction for the whole economic system. And the Spotlight also quotes a former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury saying that the banks have just been lying to the public about they're up to and what the cost will be. Now, this is a function of these auditing firms, and they're supposed to tell everybody what's really happening, but they haven't been doing that. But the curious thing is that the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is under fire for not doing its job, retained one of the major accounting firms of Arthur Anderson to conduct an outside audit of its books. And it's curious, the Spotlight says that they uncovered an expose that a former managing partner of Arthur Anderson was indicted for issuing deceptive financial statement on the status of the Drysdale Government Securities Corporation, a billion-dollar financial firm that collapsed last year.
River, 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 river.
Turning from the corporation to the military, there's a very good article in these Times this week called Uncovering the Real Defense Chair. Ronald Reagan and the people in his administration will tell you that 29% of the federal budget for next year is going to go out for national defense. And this includes most Defense Department spending, all nuclear weapons development and production, and other defense-related activities like civil defense and selective service. That all comes to $973.7 billion, which is 29% of the federal budget. However, this does not include, in these Times points out, a variety of other defense-related spending, such as veterans benefit, security money, or money for international affairs that is supposed to support U.S. foreign policy and national security objectives like the CIA and certain State Department projects. Another $2.5 billion goes into arms control and disarmament agency activities that's Defense Department related. Another $1 billion goes to propaganda. 10% of the NASA budget, that is $7.7 billion, is related to military items. So that Stephen Daggett, who's a senior research analyst with the privately funded Center for Defense Information in Washington, says if you add all of these related defense activities into the federal budget, no less than 43% of the federal budget goes for defense spending. Moreover, if you take Social Security funds out of the federal budget, much of which has already come from the employer's contributions anyway and doesn't necessarily involve government spending in a given year anyway, or it can be seen as a trust that's already been promised by the government and is thus not part of the year's budget, then No less than 56.7% of the federal budget each year goes for defense-related spending, which is somewhat of a scandal when you consider the amount of social welfare programs are being cut, aid to education, student loans, food stamps, and other human service-related activities. Now, in relationship to this, there was a good article by Archibald Gillies in the New York Times. Mr. Gillies is the president of the World Policy Institute, who points out all the easy savings that we could do in Defense Department spending and all the money thus that could be used for other human services. Mr. Gillies points out that since the Earth's life support system could already be destroyed by 250 nuclear warheads, the fact that we already have 10,000 indicates that spending money for 4,000 more in the next year, as the Reagan administration budget calls for, is nothing short of immoral.
I'm